Darkcast Network. Welcome to the dark side of podcasts.
What would you do if your dream job ended up being a $350 million fraud scheme?
Hello, friends, and welcome back. My name is Tiffany, and I am the host of True Crime Connections. This week, we are speaking with Richard Bailey. He is going to detail what it was like working with the FBI and wearing a wire while trying to uncover a $350 million fraud scheme. Thank you so much for being here, Richard. I appreciate it.
Tiffany, thank you very much for inviting me.
Of course. So really, my first question for you is, how does one become a certified fraud examiner?
All right. Well, let me just explain that a little bit. I didn't, because of everything that happened with the private equity firm that, you know, I was working at the time, and when they were liquidated, I lost my job. But after having gone through the whole discovery of the fraud and going through and doing the work for the FBI, and, you know, I actually took the certified fraud examiner's course after I did that. And basically, it's, you know, it's a lot of common sense, quite frankly. You know, if you see things that, you know, don't add up, you know, from an accounting perspective, you know, maybe that should be a little red mark that you should check out. When you get more and more and more and more and more and more of those little things that don't add up, well, maybe you have a fraud, you know, and you have to sit there all of a sudden when you hit that conclusion in your head, all of a sudden, you know, you're kind of, at that point, you know, you're kind of beholden. You have to go through and figure it out, or you become a part of it, which, you know, I clearly did not want to do.
Right. So what led you down this path? Let's jump into your story.
Well, let me just say, no one grows up wanting to be a fraud examiner. All right. It's just one of those things you learn, you wind up with. Like, you know, I have spent the last 35 years doing what's called workouts and turnarounds, where I sit there and I'm hired by private equity groups all over the country. And they may have a portfolio company that is not performing well. And they hire me and I go in there and fix it. So, you know, sometimes that involves being the bad guy. Sometimes it involves just kind of nudging things along and getting, you know, people to kind of understand what their, you know, their role and their mission and their purpose is. And sometimes it's, you know, you got to go through and, you know, be the, you know, as I said, the bad guy who lays people off and shuts people down. I've done it for about a dozen different companies over the last 35 years. I've done it all over the country. And, you know, I've seen a lot of, because nobody hires me when things are going well, you know, I'm the last person they want to call. And, you know, I've seen a lot of really ridiculous, you know, situations where, you know, you kind of sit there and look at the company and you go, how did this happen? What were you thinking? You know, but this time, you know, at Southport Lane, the private equity firm that hired me, you know, when I started having those questions and those, you know, those worries and concerns, they looked at me and gave me a raise and wanted to give me greater authority, you know, within the firm as long as I didn't pursue the angles I was going at. But unfortunately, I could not do that. I took the raise, though.
As you should.
You know, so it was an interesting, you know, 5 years. You know, I went out there. They had originally hired me. I was cleaning up the mess of a company, you know, that part of which was my fault in 2013. So I was kind of sitting around at home doing, you know, next to nothing and, you know, staring out the window and, you know, thinking that the world had passed me by. When a friend of mine called and said, listen, you know, I just joined this private equity firm. We want to make an investment in a company in northern New Jersey. You know, would you be interested in going down and kind of taking a look at it and seeing if this is, you know, worthwhile for an investment. And if it is, you know, maybe we, you know, we can put you in there as the, you know, chief operating officer or chief financial officer, which is great. I was happy with that. You know, the, it was a week's work. It was, you know, it was a very good paycheck. And so I went down there and it turns out that the whole place was, it was a family business and it's a lovely family. And, you know, but they didn't, they were losing money, but they didn't, weren't losing enough to go out of business. They had a, you know, a friend of the founder, the father, who was the chairman of the board, you know, who would write them a check when they were in a problem and things like that. So they really didn't need Southport Lane or any other outside investor. So after a week, I went to Southport's offices in Midtown Manhattan. And that's when the first time I met Alexander Chatfield Burns, who was a 26-year-old self-described financial prodigy, who also, you know, claimed at the time that he was managing over $1 billion and he owned several insurance companies, you know, and you know, all of that seemed kind of weird. But by the same token, you know, there are those stories out there on Wall Street that you just sit there and you don't know about until you stumble into them.
Welcome to Creepy Tapas,
the show where two spooky best friends give you tiny tastes of terror connected by a common ingredient.
We serve up movie reviews, mysteries, murder, mayhem, and tantalizing tales from the depths of the internet. And some random bullshit, too. All focused around a similar theme.
We blend our love of horror, oddities, and general creepiness and dig a little deeper, discovering the history, psychology, and truth behind your wildest fears.
Join us, Ash and Jordan, as we descend into full darkness every Sunday, wherever you listen to podcasts.
It's Creepy Tapas, y'all.
What?
Proud members of the Darkcast Network.
But anyway, you know, yeah, I went to Southport Lane. I sat down in the conference room. They looked at me, the Alex Burns, the CEO of the firm, the majority owner of the firm, comes bumbling in, looks like, you know, a disheveled mess. And he looks over at me and he goes, should I buy this company? Who will remain nameless, and I didn't name him in the book. And I said, no. And he said, why not? I said, because it's a family-owned business and they're going to have, and every Christmas, every Easter, every Thanksgiving, every wedding, every 4th of July, they're going to have a board meeting and you're not going to be there. So you're going to lose all your money. They don't lose enough money. They really don't need you. And, you know, I don't know why you would do this. It's just going to be a problem and a headache going forward. So he agreed and he didn't do the deal. I think he was so taken aback by the fact that I had said this is a dumb idea because nobody said that to him. I mean, you know, there was a certain amount of, you know, when you get to those really, really smart or people who fancy themselves to be really, really smart, that and when they're controlling assets in business, you know, they don't, people don't say no to them too often. And I just sat there and said, listen, this is a dumb idea. So he apparently liked that fact. And so he hired me to buy this, to look at and fix this vineyard out on Long Island that he had already purchased. So I said, sure, you know, I like the paycheck, you know. It was nice to be back in, you know, the swing of things and feel relevant in the, you know, in the financial world again. And so I went out to this vineyard and what I discovered was just another complete disaster. I couldn't figure out how they paid $12.75 million in cash for something that I couldn't value more than like 5.5, 5.75. Nothing made sense. Cash, you know, so, you know, why do, and the company was losing $1.2 million, $1.3 million a year. Why are you going to pay, you know, $7 million over the value of the company for the privilege of losing another $1.2 million, $1.5 million a year? So right. You know, things like that, that's when things like that just don't add up. And you just kind of go, okay, what's going on here? So, and it just kind of went sideways and downhill from there over time.
So, this guy, he's 26 years old, got millions just to spend wherever he wants in cash. Did you ever ask him, where's your money coming from?
This is the penultimate moment of this story, which set everything off. All right, so I buy onto the idea that he's got a lot of money, that they legitimately own these insurance companies, and that they're trying to invest, you know, the capital from the insurance companies in private equity investments. So I have a very, very good friend, an extremely smart and honest guy, who came to me with a deal that he was looking for $15 million. And I was like, I liked the deal. I went over it. I mean, you know, so I said, let's go. I'll pitch it to Alex at South Port Lane. So one day we were there. We sit there. My friend's there. My other friend, Jeff, who worked at South Port Lane, good guy, wasn't a part of the shenanigans. And all of a sudden, Burns is sitting there. You know, we come in. Brad, my friend Brad, who's got the deal that he wants us to look at, does his pitch. You know, Burns looks at me and goes, what do you think, Richard? I said, I like it. They got the buy side, the inside. I said, I know these people. We're going to make money. And he says, okay, you do it. That was it. You know, $15 million. By the way, during that time, he barely ever looked up from his phone. And so, you know, I sit there and I'm like, okay, let's end it here and get out of here. This is as good as it's going to get. But my friend Brad is, you know, just one of these, you know, deathly honest people. And he can ask the most cringeworthy questions in the most non-threatening, polite manner. And he goes, hey, Alex, you know, while you're here, you know, how did you get control of all these insurance companies? And Burns was walking out of the door of the conference room at that time. He hears the question, spins around on his heel, looks at us, and with this Cheshire Cat grin, says, Jesus with a telescope on Mars couldn't figure out how I did this. And we were all like, what? He actually said that. We're sitting there and all of a sudden, you know, we're trying not to laugh. Burns leaves, goes back to his office, you know, never taking his eyes off the phone. And we go outside. And we're like, are you kidding me? Did he just say that? And my friend Brad looks at me and goes, be very, very careful. Something's very, very wrong here. And, you know, Jeff was smart. He said, you know, I think I'm going to update my resume. Me, at that point, I'm kind of hooked. It's like, you know, I'm like, you got to find out. I can't help myself. I got to go find out. I've been told that I'm the kind of person that in a bad situation has to go and look under the rock to see what the ugly that comes out. And, you know, that's not untrue, you know. And so then I just, you know, started collecting evidence and data and things like that. And about 5 months, 6 months later, Alex just disappeared. He walked out, literally walked out of a meeting with me. He said, you know, and I looked at him, he's looking at his phone, and all of a sudden he goes, you know, oh, you know, F word, oh, F word, oh, F word. I go, and I look at him, he's 26 years old. I'm 53 at the time. And I'm like, you know, so I got a son who's 22. He's just graduated from college. And I'm sitting there going, what's the matter, kid? He goes, I hate my insurance companies. He gets up and he walks away. Nobody ever saw him again.
What?
Nobody ever saw him again. He writes a letter handing over all his shares to his CFO, who now becomes the sole owner of this whole mess. And never heard from him again. You know, so at that point, things were starting to get real. That's when things were really, really weird. And I figured it out that, you know, I had bank statements that they had given me to kind of reconcile accounts at the Vineyard. I had, you know, securities documents that I had pulled off the internet that they had filed, which were clearly wrong and, you know, and false, you know, which is a very big no-no. I wasn't sure that I had these guys. And so I hired a private detective who I knew, you know, it's actually a very famous private detective in New York, and he's also an actor named Bo Deedle. And Bo's firm goes into it, and they sit there and they go, there's there's multiple federal offenses here. And I'm like, oh boy. And I'm just kind of like sitting there going, okay, listen, I've handed it off to you guys. You know, I'm done. You know, I'm out of here. You know, just, can I just go back to like growing grapes and making, you know, crushing grapes and making wine and things like that? I don't want to be a part of any of all this. And so, but you know, that wasn't the way it worked out. We finally went to, well, I have a neighbor who lives about, you know, five houses down, is an FBI agent. And, you know, this is something, maybe 6-7 months have passed, you know, and I've got this evidence of a major fraud. And I'm sitting there going, what do I do? How do you, you know, how do you deal with that? You know, I talked to my personal lawyer. He's like, don't get involved, you know, and I'm sitting there going, yeah, but I think I have to, you know, because I didn't want to be on the wrong side of it. Something, you know, my feeling in those situations is, you know, you're going to get caught. You might as well be on the good side, on the right side of that, you know, of that horrible, you know, misadventure that if you get, you know, in the court process. And so I was, you know, I bumped into my neighbor literally at the town dump on a Sunday. And he's like, hey, Rich, how you doing? I'm like, hey, Dave. He goes, what's going on? And I just sat there and I just spilled it out. And I'm like, I think I need to talk business with you. He goes, and you know, he immediately gets, you know, FBI face on. And he goes, are you in trouble? And I said, no. But I think my firm is, let me tell you what I found. He goes, go home. Keep your phone in your hand. You're going to get a phone call from the white collar division in Boston. And he goes, within half an hour, and, you know, 35 minutes later, you know, all of a sudden the phone rings and I answer it. And it's a guy from the white collar division in Boston FBI office. We'd agree to have breakfast the next morning. I give him my evidence. They said, yep, absolutely all the hallmarks of a major fraud. And then nothing happened for like 6 months. You know, so I go back to Bo Deedle and I said, what's going on? What, you know, can we find out what's going on? He calls the U.S. attorney for the Southern District of Manhattan, a guy named Preet Bharara. And they sit there and tell him, we don't want any part of this. They wave him off. They wave him off. So, you know, I'm sitting there in Bo's office in, you know, in Midtown, and I'm going, what does this mean? And he had like five guys in the room. He goes, this is obviously a federal crime. It's got to be run out of Maine Justice in Washington, D.C. I'm like, okay, so how do we get to them? And they introduced me to the amazing and wonderful and, you know, I will love him forever for it, for the way he took care of me. A former U.S. attorney who was a defense attorney, a criminal defense attorney in New York named Michael Weinstein. Michael's a very measured guy. I mean, he's, you know, you talk to Michael and he's, you know, I mean, he's used to having his clients in handcuffs and things like that. He's kind of unflappable. And, you know, I'm sitting there and I go through the whole thing. It's okay. Let me poke around. About 2 weeks later, 3 weeks later, you know, and again, Michael's a very unflappable guy. And I am sitting in my car because in order for me to get back to, I lived south of Boston, back to, you know, south of Boston from Long Island, where I have to take a ferry service from Orient Point, New York, over to New London, Connecticut. I am sitting there in my car about to board the ferry. Phone rings. Michael Weinstein. Hey, Michael. And all of a sudden, now I said, Michael's a very, you know, measured guy. A torrent of words just fall out of his mouth. He goes, are you sitting down? I said, I'm in my car. You know, he goes, there's a massive task force looking after the Southport Lane thing. You know, the FBI, the SEC, the Commodities Futures Trading Commission, the Department of Justice. He goes, you know, and there's a task force. I just got off the phone. I've been talking to the lead investigative agent for the FBI, and he wants to meet you. And I'm like, okay. You know, he goes, and Richard, I want you to, he wants to know one more thing. And I said, yeah. He goes, they want to know if you'll wear a wire with the Southport Lane guys. And I said, I never saw that question coming, by the way. Never in a million years. I'm just trying to sit there and hand it off to the authorities and get out of Dodge and collect my paychecks and, you know, and try to keep my hands clean of all this. And, you know, I said, I've got to think about this. Can I call you on Monday? Then I also realized I have to tell my wife. So she knows some of what's going on, not all of it. And this is an entirely different, you know, this just elevated everything. And so, you know, I came home, I told her, and, you know, being the very wise woman that she is, she sat there and said, I can see you've already made up your mind to do this. She was right. I had. And she goes, I just ask that you be careful. And I said, I will. And she says, and don't do anything stupid. And I promised I wouldn't. And, you know, with no idea how to keep from breaking that promise. But, you know, so I was in. I was in. I met the FBI the next week in Michael Weinstein's office in Manhattan. And, you know, they interviewed me for about 2 hours. And then about the next 2 hours, you know, they taught me how to do all that silly spy stuff, like, you know, record calls.
I mean, that had to be very interesting. Very interesting.
It was. I remember getting up. It was like 4:30 in the afternoon, getting up from the conference table. And, you know, this is one of those big, huge law firms in New York. Yeah, I mean, it's just the conference table is about, you know, 15 yards long. I mean, you know, you could have a, you know, miniature football game in there. and you know, the FBI guys leave. There was an FBI, there was two FBI people. There was somebody from the Securities and Exchange Commission, and there was somebody from the IRS Criminal Investigation Division. And I'm sitting there and I just like, I got to get out of here. And I look at Michael and say, I got to go get a drink. I got to do something. You know, so I walked over to my favorite little bar about four blocks away and about two blocks from the hotel. I was saying, I had about three martinis. And, you know, I think the only thing I had to eat that night for dinner was, you know, a salad consisting of the olives that were in my martinis, you know, and went back to the hotel, fell dead sound asleep, woke up at like 5 o'clock the next morning. And, you know, and everything changed after that, you know, so they, it was pretty wild. It was pretty wild. You go through a lot of ups and downs emotionally. There's a whole lot of, should I be doing this? There's a whole lot of, you know, what am I getting myself into? You know, why am I doing this? You know, my, we had a neighbor when I was growing up named Pat Conroy, and she was a very funny, you know, Irish woman, you know, and I just couldn't stop thinking about what something she said, you know, was like, who died and made you boss? And I'm kind of looking at this thing going, you know, why? Who made me like, you know, Mr. Crime Fighter and things like that. So, I mean, it was weird. It was genuinely weird. And it went on for quite a while.
Well, I mean, you had an in and they trusted you already. So I'm guessing, so Alex is gone, but you're still able to make contact with his company.
Well, right. Because they still technically own the vineyard. They don't. They're trying to tell me that they don't. But, you know, basically they had lost a court case in Delaware and they no longer owned it. And technically the, you know, Delaware insurance commissioner owned the vineyard, but nobody was telling anybody what anybody was doing. I couldn't even get a hold of the attorneys for the Delaware insurance commissioner. We tried for about 6 months, you know, FedEx letters, everything, emails, you know, everything like that, certified mail, never got a hold of them. And the guys at Southport Lane were behaving as if they owned everything and nothing was wrong. And I'm sitting there going, nothing's wrong. I said, you know, I'm talking to the FBI four times a week, you know,
right.
You know? And so it was definitely a period of just extraordinary uncertainty.
Right.
You know, and you know, the FBI are good guys and they were protectful of me and everything like that. But they never really told me what was going on. And they only tell you what they really need right now, right then at that moment. So, you know, it was, that was 2015 and 2016. 2021, the vineyards have been sold, not to me, although I bid on them, but I didn't get it. Somebody with a lot more deep pockets than, you know, I had access to at that moment, got it. And so I was kind of home licking my wounds. And it was October 2021. And I get a call from the lead FBI agent. Now, I haven't talked to him in probably a year, year and a half. And the whole time we were doing the, you know, the investigation stuff, you know, there was always a strict protocol, which they told me that first meeting in Michael Weinstein's office, that here's what we're going to do. I'm going to text you, say you got a minute for a call. And you say yes, or in 10 minutes, or in an hour, or no. You know, and, you know, if you say in 1 hour, I'm going to call you 1 hour. And, you know, damn if they didn't do that. They're very punctual people. And so I'm driving home, and from, I think I'd been like Home Depot or something like that, you know, something mundane. And I'm sitting there, and all of a sudden the phone rings, and up comes the FBI agent's name on the phone. I'm going, what is wrong here? And so I hit it. I said, hello. And he goes, I just want to, you know, first he's like, you know, hey, how you doing? I'm like, good. Why are you calling me?
Right.
You know, you're not calling me to find out how I'm doing. And he said, I just want you to know, before it gets in the media, Alex Burns killed himself yesterday. Yeah.
Oh, my gosh.
He committed suicide. My first response was, you know, you can bleep this out later, was holy fuck. My second response was, you know, I'm not surprised he wasn't tough enough to go to prison. And he was facing prison time of 20 years because they stole $350
million. $350
million. Millions.
That is like, it's like some Ocean's 11 shit, you know?
It is. I mean, you know, and that's kind of the thing that's always bothered me. Why? I mean, how did they pull this off? I know how they pulled it off, and I'm just amazed that they were able to pull it off because, I mean, this is going to sound weird. They weren't bad guys. I knew them pretty well, you know, and I hung out with them and, you know, had dinner with them at restaurants in New York City with them on a number of occasions, you know, and got along with them, you know, but, you know, how they just didn't appear to me to be that extraordinary that they could pull off a $350 million fraud. And it turns out it wasn't that good of a fraud. Basically, what they did is they bought these insurance companies, and the insurance companies all had slight financial problems. So they literally made up stock certificates on their office computers and gave them to a bank to hold for a year. And that bank, shame on that bank, sat there and said, yep, this is $50 million. You're right. And it was just paper that they printed earlier, you know, the day before. And then they sat there and created more of that paper and sold it to the insurance companies. Because insurance companies, you know, have to have lots of cash on their, you know, balance sheet in their accounts to pay out claims and things like that. So then they, you know, they started selling the insurance companies that they owned their bogus securities, taking the money in, and that's where they bought the vineyard. You know, so it made a lot of, so all of a sudden when you think back on it, it made a lot of sense. Like, you know, why would these guys pay $12.75 million for a vineyard worth $5.7 million? Well, it's because it wasn't their money.
Right.
You know. So, yeah. So
that's crazy.
It was crazy. And the fact of the matter is they got away with it. Until they didn't.
Well, right. Did you ever find out what was on his phone that made him freak out and go into hiding?
Yeah. Actually, he was notified, and everything started to cave in on him. And he was notified by another insurance company that they wanted to unwind a deal and buy back. They didn't think that the securities that he had given them were valuable, and they wanted to unwind a deal. So therefore, he was going to have to come up with, you know, I don't know, $25 or $30 million, which, you know, clearly at that point he didn't have, you know? So yeah, that was what was on the phone.
Wow. And, how did they find him?
The Wall Street Journal wrote a front page article about the whole thing in March of 15, around the same time I'm first making my contact with the FBI. How the Wall Street Journal got the article, I don't know.
You know, so
that's,
I mean,
that's what started the whole thing.
It's pretty much a Ponzi scheme. Like, I take your money and then I'm going to take that money to buy or pay somebody else's stuff to then.
Right. Yeah.
Right. Okay.
Yeah. That's all it was, you know, and they're hoping that someday they're going to sit there and make some investment, which was going to make it all good, make it all work. But, you know, it didn't work that way. That's not the way those things, generally those things don't pan out that way.
Especially not when you just printed it at the house. I mean,
I actually heard someone at Southport Lane say, oh, they printed those off their computers. And I didn't believe it. I didn't believe anybody would be that stupid.
Well.
So, yeah, well, you know, I was wrong.
Sometimes it's also like who you know, though. So, you know, they might have gone to the bank a couple times, made a relationship with the person. You know, like it depends on how
they really were. Without question. I mean, you know, and the banks are charging them big fees. They're sitting there paying the fees, making sure there's enough money in the bank accounts, real cash in the bank accounts so they can pay the fees. And, you know, the bankers, you know, they're a fee-driven, you know, that's a fee-driven industry. So if you can sit there and keep on paying big fees and you got some managing director at one of the banks that sits there and says, I'm going to get fees out of this guy, you know, these guys are going to be good for me and my business, you know, for the next 10 years, they're going to go out of their way to kind of sit there and make sure that, you know, that the customer's protected, that in this case, Southport Lane was protected. So they kept on doing it.
Wow. So it ended up happening with all these properties and everything. They just ended up selling them for real money.
Well, the lawyers for the insurance companies took over. I had many, many meetings with that group of people. Interesting. You know, I mean, again, back in the big conference rooms in Manhattan, I'll tell you one quick story. I was in there for one meeting. It was myself, Michael Weinstein, and on the other side of the table was 12 lawyers from the biggest firms in Manhattan. And, you know, so we spent a couple hours. They're grilling me. I mean, I didn't do anything wrong. And I can't tell them that I'm working for the FBI, by the way. They don't know that. You know, they think I'm, you know, just, you know, some idiot who's managing a vineyard. And so we go through the whole meeting and they all leave and I look at Michael Weinstein and I said, what do you think that meeting just cost? He goes, at least 50 to 75 grand was billed just then in that 2 hours. So, I mean, the lawyers had a fee extravaganza on this, a smorgasbord. And they wound up selling off all the pieces, you know, and, you know, I'll say this, you know, I might get in trouble for this, but lawyers don't really care what the sale price is. They just want it off their, they want the transaction closed and they want to sit there and say, yep, sold it. We've recovered X amount, you know? So, you know, that's what happened. Then in May of 2019, I get a call from the lead investigation agent. It's about 7 o'clock at night, and he's definitely had a few drinks. And he's like, Richard, I just want you to know, he has a deep Southern drawl. He goes, Richard, I just want you to know, they're all being arrested right now. And I was like, okay, I guess, you know. You know, and, you know, and I said, well, congratulations. And he said, congratulations, everything like that. So they wound up all getting arrested. Alex Burns actually pled guilty secretly and aided the FBI in the investigation for like 4 years.
Really?
Before he committed suicide. Yes. And then, you know, and so the one guy, these guys had taken a unprovable, you know, the provenance for a Caravaggio painting, which is actually the original sitting in the Prado in Spain. And they had purchased it for $40 million, of which they put $1.2 million down and they financed the rest through, you know, a series of, you know, shell companies. And the guy who got one guy got a $1.2 million finder's fee. transaction fee out of it. And like an idiot, he didn't declare it on his taxes. So he was the first to get arrested on tax fraud. He was released during COVID, a compassionate release. The next guy, you know, Rob McGraw, I mean, I've always felt badly about him. He was, you know, kind of a meek, mild mannered, wicked smart, just sharp as a tack guy. But, you know, he sat there and vouched that the securities printed on the computer were actually worth what they said they were. And he got 18 months, did about 9. He's out. I mean this when I say this. I hope he's doing well. He was the one who got, you know, he didn't get anything out of this, put it this way. He wasn't, you know, living high on the hog or anything like that. And, you know, the guy who inherited, the CFO who inherited everything after Burns took a powder, he was sentenced to 60 months. He's probably done about 2.5 now, and he gets out in a month. And I feel bad. This is the strange paradox of this. I actually feel really badly about this. These guys had families, they had mortgages, you know, they had, you know, wives, things like that. And I know it was there. I know they would have gotten caught anyway. And I know that they are the architects of their own problems. But I just can't imagine what it must be like to all of a sudden, you know, have the FBI knock at your door and read you your rights in front of your family.
I don't want to know.
Yeah. I mean, you know, I mean, it just, and that's the part that always bothers me is like, you know, the effect it had on their families and things like that.
You know, well, right. But you have to look at that in a whole, in a sense, like when you're getting into something, unless you really don't know what you're getting into, you know what I mean? Maybe you're naive. Maybe you didn't know the full caliber of it. But when you know, like, clearly I'm getting all this money that I probably shouldn't be and not really in the best ways, you kind of almost got to be ready for that knock on the door.
Yeah, I guess you're right. I don't think these guys ever thought about that. I, you know, again, I've seen a lot of guys commit fraud. They have. You know, when you take over, you know, companies that are in trouble, you know, business people, owners, you know, executives, they make a lot of bad decisions trying to sit there because they don't have a lot of good decisions to make. They make bad decisions, you know, and try to sit there and say, well, which is the least bad option? But still, it's still a bad option. You know, these guys, you know, they were, I don't think they ever thought that it was, that they were doing that much wrong. And I think, like, I've seen a lot of these guys who they're like, and there's one thing that's always similar to all of them. They always sit there and say, no one will know. And they all think they can get away with it. And they all think that they're smarter than the law. You know, and the law has these big, huge buckets, you know, these statutes. It does, which no matter which sit there and kind of scoop you up for all sorts of malevolent behavior, you know. And so it was kind of, you know, you can't, you're really not going to get away with it. And I never could, I can't imagine myself living a life like that, where you got to, you're looking over your shoulder and you're waking up in the middle of the night going, is today the day, you know, or you hear like, you know,
right,
something, you hear something on your roof in the middle of the winter, you know, and you're sitting there going, is that the FBI knocking down my door? I mean, I just couldn't live like that.
I don't know if there's any amount of money that would make that worth it. I really don't, unless, you know, you like completely changed your name, went to a place that doesn't. Yeah, I mean, you have to like go above and beyond.
Yeah.
But I could not. I don't even think you could put a number on for me to live that way, because that sounds miserable. You have all this money and there's nothing you can do with it.
Well, right. I mean, well, that's what money laundering's about, you know, whole other set of problems, you know. But yeah, I mean, you just wind up compounding the problem.
Right.
And your liability for it, you know, trying to keep from getting caught. But yeah, it was a, it's a very American tale, because, you know, here you have a bunch of guys who were smart, well-educated, all of them are from good families and everything like that, you know, and they, you know, they got hooked into the Wall Street, we're all going to be really, really rich mentality, you know, and they figure that the best way and the shortest distance between two points of where I am today, and I'm going to get really, really rich, is they're going to sit there and cut a lot of corners, you know, and they're going to sit there and break the law. And they're going to rationalize it to themselves by saying, nobody will know. Nobody's going to find out. And that's what happens. And I've seen it, you know,
right.
And I saw it with these guys, you know.
Or you think, I'm too low down on the tadpole. They're going to be after the bigger guys. Like, I'm the last.
Oh, I know. Yes. The FBI only devotes those, you know, that's where the big guys. That's what happens in tax fraud, by the way, is people sit there and say, you know, they'll cheat on their taxes and they'll be like, you know, nobody will. They're only going to go after the big guys. Wrong. They go after the little guys because they're the easiest ones to convict.
Right.
They don't have the resources. They don't have the resources. They don't have the lawyers. They don't have the advisors, anything like that, that can fight something to, you know, to the death, you know, in court. So, yeah, it's a very American story, you know, and my part of it is, you know, you kind of wake up one day and say, what do I do now that I know what I know? And that's tough.
Right.
You know, I mean, you know, my wife and kids were like, you know, what's going on with dad? You know, because all of a sudden I'm having, you know, I'm walking out into the driveway and climbing in my car and having phone conversations because I'm talking to the FBI.
Right.
You know, there's, and I can't talk in front of them. You know, I mean, there's all sorts of, you know, little things like that. I mean, you know, I'm recording phone calls. You know, I'm wearing a wire. I'm going out to dinner in, you know, New Jersey. And, you know, there's two FBI agents outside. There's two in the restaurant. And there's two behind me to protect me. You know, and it's
no
just,
pressure.
No. Here's the weird part. I actually, in those situations, I actually get so dialed in, focused, that it doesn't bother me until it's all over.
I could get that.
Yeah. I mean, I get so focused. Everything kind of slows down, you know. And I said, okay, here's where we are. This is what I got to do. And then, you know, hopefully you get out of there.
Right. So what do you do now?
Well, now I'm working for a company down that's actually in Southwest Georgia. It's a waste to energy company that's trying to develop their new technology and commercialize it. It's kind of fun. Want me to write another book. I don't know. Writing's hard. You know, even writing this book was hard. This book was really just a series of blog posts that I decided when I was unemployed that I was just, you know, because my mother, 91, she's 95 now, you know, at the time is just sitting there going, I told her the story. And she's like, write it down. You know, this is a great story. So that's how it started. I'm thinking about, you know, I'm getting to the point where it's like, okay, what's next? I'm 66. I'm not ready to stop working. But by the same token, you know, I don't know if I can make a living as a writer. That's certainly been devalued over the last, you know, 20 years.
Well, with AI coming, I think we're all screwed in a lot of different areas.
I would agree with you. You know, So that's what's going on.
Very cool. Where can people find your book? Is it Amazon?
You can find it a couple different places. You can find it. The website is www.rdbailey.com. You can buy it on Amazon. You can buy it at Barnes & Noble. And, you know, there it is in hardcover. It is in Kindle and audiobook.
Awesome. Very good. Yeah. Is there anything else that you wanted to add?
No. Thank you very much, though.
Yes, no. Thank you for being here. This was interesting. I felt like I was like in an episode of like I said, Ocean's 11. Like what? Or Boiler Room.
I've had Boiler Room. Yeah, I have had a lot. I've had a lot of people say that this should be a movie, and I will tell you that there is an agent in Hollywood trying to pitch it. But you know, that and you know, $10 will get me a Starbucks coffee.
Hey, I mean, free coffee.
yeah. So I'm not exactly planning on having that happen. So
right. Yeah, I mean, you never know. You never know.
You never know. Yeah. You're absolutely correct.
Thank you so much for being here. I appreciate you sharing.
Tiffany,
the story.
Thank you very much.
All right. You have a good rest of your day.
You too. Thank you.
Thank you.
I think we all know somebody who can benefit from this episode. Please make sure to share it with them. And thank you guys so much for listening to my podcast. This really means a lot to me. If one of my episodes has helped you in any way, I would really like to know. It's important for me to know that the work that I'm doing is actually helping people. If you want more of me, make sure to subscribe to my YouTube channel and follow me on Instagram and TikTok. If you or anyone you know is in need of national hotlines, please go to truecrimeconnections.com. I have all the phone numbers there listed for anything that you could possibly imagine. All right, my renowned roots community, keep building hope and gaining strength. Until next time.